Question number 14932, Norman Edwards, reel 5.
Mr. Edwards, reel 5. Now, we're just coming to... When you were out of the line in Plug Street Village, what sort of duties would you have? I mean, during the day?
I don't think we would have any.
In the night? I mean, I know you went... What about working parties?
There was no... I don't remember being on a working party.
What about the time you carried up the machine gun post-frame?
We did. What was that?
What was happening?
I think that the machine gun section people, the big people, were always on the lookout for the likely places. And I think on this particular occasion, they had chosen a spot, but it had to be dug out and created. It was a location that was very helpful from our point of view, gave a good field of fire, but I think we had to make it. But I can't remember whether... See, there was one department in the army in those days, the sort of working department, I forget what they called themselves.
The Royal Engineers.
Yes, the RE people made this framework, and as far as I remember, we had to carry it up one night.
Wasn't that difficult?
It was a bit difficult, a bit heavy, but it felt rather vague. It's until you mentioned it, I'd forgotten completely about that thing.
Anything else you'd do while you were out of the line? Or any other stories that you remember from Plug Street before we move on?
I see, it was the Plug Street, the bars at Pont-Niep was the main thing. And
okay. So do you remember the move to Messines?
Well, I remember that we passed a notice at the end of the area there saying this section was handed over intact to the 48th South Midland Division. And so as we were leaving it, you see, we'd been there from towards the end of March until the beginning of May. We had a similar notice up, division had put up. This was handed over intact to some next division, I forget who it was, that after we'd been there 2 months. Then we moved gradually south, sort of moving, going into the trenches in various places that I can't remember exactly where, but we were slowly sort of moving south back into France again, and
so this is when you went into the line at Messines, and then you marched to Neuf Bakui and to Houlonville. That's that period. You don't remember that in detail. Don't remember this phase in detail then.
And they're in the diaries, but I've forgotten them now in detail. I know we stopped at one place where there was a coal mining division, and the buildings, most of the buildings were in German hands, but they were still running the dynamos and so forth to provide electricity. They didn't realize that some of the wires were coming to our side of the line, and we were getting electricity made by the Germans.
Any other memories? And just any other stories from that time? Or what's the next thing you remember?
Well, it was just sort of... I'm afraid they I should need to glance at my diaries to cite the details of things that happened then.
So when's the next thing you do remember?
Well, gradually, as we moved south, until we finally finished up at an area around Ebertone.
Right. That's when you were down towards the Somme area.
Yes.
Now, there's just a couple of things in your diary I wanted to ask you a bit more about. That is, at one time, when you were at Herlonville, you had Battalion Sports Day. Battalion Sports Day.
Oh, yes. We were out on that move down, we did. We had divisional sports, too.
What do you remember of the sports day?
Well, all I know is that... one thing was to see how quickly you could get a machine gun out of the limbers and mounted and ready for firing. And there was the 4th Gloucesters were alongside us, and the 6th were there, and we were sort of competing with one another over that area. It's a simple thing. But other than that, there were games of football and cricket and so forth.
That cricket, that's quite a new... What
I don't know where we got the cricket bats from, I don't know.
Did you play cricket?
Oh yes, a bit. It's one of my favourite games after the war.
Now, as you march, would you sing any songs? Because in your thing you've got notes about... In your diary you have notes about the sort of songs you used to sing on the march. I wondered if you remembered any of them. There's one... Why can't the packs go in the limber?
Well, you can... Yeah, why can't the packs go on the limber? Why can't they have the packs quite there? As we walk along the road, they make an awful load and don't half make the regulars stare. If I made a verse... You see, it was understood by us that the regular Maxim gunners didn't carry packs. See what you can do against the sergeant, or officer, a sergeant, or a pair... In the beautiful summertime, marching would be fine if we only had the packs right there.
another one, marching, marching, marching. Do you remember that one?
Marching, marching, marching. Always be well marching. From Rivale till lights out, we're marching all the time.
And Jean from Aberdeen. I've not heard of that one before. Jean from Aberdeen.
Oh yes, that was another one. We had a fellow in the section named McGregor, who his pet name of course became Haggis. He's always known to us as Haggis McGregor, and he introduced that Jean from Aberdeen. She's the finest lassie I've ever seen. I forget how the rest of the verse went on.
Now, when you went into...
Oh, one of the most important songs that we used to sing at that time was, you can talk about your rifle, you can talk until you stifle, but it's only just a trifle to the gun we have to know. The Maxim gun, of course, is the pride of all the forces, but just unhitch the horses and let the something go. I think we inherited that from the regulars.
Now, you moved into the line on the 30th of July 1915, and you went to Serre first. Before Hebuterne, you went to Serre.
Yes.
Now, what do you remember about the front line at Serre? Because you were taking it over from the French, weren't you?
Yes.
And it was very wet.
I'm afraid that part of it becomes rather... faded. There's nothing vitally outstanding there except wet, muddy trenches at times.
What about the smell? There was a problem. One of the things you mentioned in your diary is that the French left a lot of rubbish lying around and it was very smelly, and you used creosote. Do you remember that now, or is that gone?
Yes, I believe that was so, but I don't remember the detail. From the French there. alongside of me was Harry Steele. And as I sat there, I was doing this, sort of scratching him, and he said, "Eddie, my lad, you're lousy."
Was that the first time you'd had lice?
That was the first time that I'd found had these particular dugouts that we took over were apparently there's a lot of unpleasant little creatures there that got into one's clothes.
How did you try and control the lice? What did you use to kill the lice?
Well, I rode home at once, you see, and Boots provided some antidote for what they called insect in the trenches. We used to powder your thing. We didn't suffer much from it, I don't think, because we occasionally had baths and where all your clothing was deloused by a machine.
Now, when you were at rest at Say, you went to Salie, I think, and there's some photographs that you've given to the War Museum for copying of your section in and out of the line at this time. Now, who had the camera and how? Because you weren't supposed to have cameras, were you?
No. Well, there was a. This man, Joe Arnold, was the one that had the small camera. And I think, I don't know whether I mentioned it, that we used to have what we called the section photographic water bottle, where we, whenever anybody went on leave, we used to we'd cut the bottom of this bottle, and we used to push the films up in and sew the khaki cloth round it, so that if you were going on to the leave boat, and the police might have heard this rattling, they say, "What have you got in there?" We used to say, "Well, the cork fell down inside." They said, "Oh, that's all right." I don't know whether I told you the story about when Mr. Arnold had the films developed, and he had got a friend of his there who was working for Pear Soap, who begged to have those things. He said, "I could incorporate those in an advert." Mr. Arnold very wisely said, "No, don't do that. It might be recognised."
That was a picture, particularly, of you having a bath in a tin bath. That's the one that they particularly wanted, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, that was it. That was in the. That was in Heberturn, I think.
Well, let's move on to Heberturn. Could you describe the front line at Heberturn? Because it was apparently laid with bricks. That's unusual.
Well, it was most unusual. It was quite a nice little town. The church had been rather badly bashed about. But obviously some regular division had used the paving stones or what have you to make the floor of the trenches leading up to the front line, which was most unusual to be able to have trenches that really were firm underfoot. I also know that on the edge of that, facing the Germans, there was a remains of the orchard of a farm, and there were some apples used to get at night time, and after the shelling we used to go out and pick up these apples. They were the most delicious apples I've ever tasted, I think. But that piece of line opposite us there, which was Gobicore wood, was reputed to be one of the strongest areas of the whole Western Front.
How could you describe what you could see from the front line?
Yes, on our own front line, we could look across, and the ground very gently rose. As usual, the Germans seized the ground when they were strongest, you see. At this place, there was the wood which jutted out and formed a sort of a salient sticking out. That was Gomicore wood. And it gave them a field of fire of sort of 75%. So they could shoot there from right round to here, because they were out on a point. But Gomicore wood was a very famous sort of spot. And yet it was there that our Colonel Micklin decided to raid the place, even though it was the strongest. And we carried out this raid. And
would that be the raid on, I think, the 25th of November?
Yes. Yeah.
Could you describe how that raid was planned and what your role was?
Well,
you stayed in the trench. You were covering fire.
A number of men were decided to tell them. In between us and the Germans, out in this open space, there was a hedge, which was known as the Z hedge. And they, on this particular night, they crawled out there pretty early on, about sort of 9 o'clock, so that it was dark. And they also had a telephone wire out to it. And they all, sort of the actual raiding party, assembled out there. And about 1:30, 1 to 2 o'clock in the morning, the officer in charge of this party, who was lying out in Z hedge, phoned back to the colonel and said that the moon was rising and it was his brightest day out there, and he didn't know whether we ought to go on with it. And the colonel replied, "Carry on," which we did. I was not in that. We were simply machine guns on the side, you see, sort of backing up in case the Germans counterattacked. But the few hand-hardy chaps that did go out there, they finished up by capturing one German, I think.
Now, your gun jammed at the German. Do you remember your gun jamming? Something broke on your gun.
You occasionally got a jab in the gun, and there was certain action. The only one I can remember about the clearing was crank handle on buffing spring, pull belt left front.
I thought you had to go back for a spare part during that raid, though, didn't you?
Yes, one cotter or something failed, and I said, well, I'll go along to the other gun and see if I can get one. And by that time, we'd be back, and the German barrage was down, and it was very, very dangerous going. There were shells bursting all around. Part of the time, I crawled on my hands and knees.
How did you feel in a bombardment like that? I mean, were you nervous?
Well, you just felt that any minute you might be killed and so forth, but you've got to do your job. You sort of went on with it and hoped for the best. And you were fortunate enough to get away with it.
Now, I just want to look at some specific things that happened while you were at Hebuterne.
Yes.
Did you have sort of dugouts there, or where did you sleep overnight?
Well, in Hebuterne, the ordinary dugouts up at the front line, but where we were billeted, which was back in the village, was in a house that had a cellar that we used. But it was quite a difficult one. I know one of our sergeants, the fellow named Ayres, Bess Ayres, the fellow who became the chief reporter for the the Bristol papers, he used to tell us, go down into the dugout. And we all used to say, oh, blow that, which is double of the fact down there, we should be all right, nothing's going to hit us. We very rarely used the dugout, and we very rarely got hit by it. But occasionally there would be a salvo of shells would come over round the church area, and various places were hit, and it wasn't very healthy.
What about the Minenwerfers, the Minis, the German trench mortars? That's where you met them as well.
Those were only used in the front line. They were sort of, as they say, you'd hear a thump, and you'd sometimes see the thing going up, but at night time you see a trail of sparks because the fuse on this thing was it, and as soon as it got to the top position, the position of the thing was such the sparks went out, and this thing would fall down, and then there'd be a pretty bad burst with a 10-foot crater. Very unpleasant.
Would you try and dodge them? I mean, would you have time to try and move?
Well, it's not much apparent. All you could see was a trail of sparks going up in the air. You just hope for the best.
Now, just another thing is that on one time you used your machine gun to try and stop a German sniper. You hunted him.
Well, I don't know whether that was the episode when he kept knocking our sandbags back into the trenches. I described that in detail.
Do you remember it now?
Oh, yes, very well. Dave.
Could you tell us about it?
Well, when we've arrived at this place facing Serre...
So this is back at Serre, right?
The front line was in a rather scruffy condition. And the colonel said, you've got to put this parapet right. And that night, 250 sandbags came up by the carrier, and we spent all our reserve night filling these sandbags and then mounting them until we got a long area with looking, just right, a decent sandbag. Next morning, at about 10 o'clock, as far as I can remember, we heard bang, 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 single shots. And then somebody came along and said, they're knocking all those sandbags we put up last night back into our own trenches. So I thought, well, we're going to do something about this. So I borrowed a telescope from headquarters, where they had one, went further down the line, very carefully mounted this thing so that only the lens was showing, and there was sandbag, and I kept watch on this area where I thought the thing was coming from, and I finally spotted a little sort of rectangular thing, and I could see two dark eyes in it, and then they would disappear. And alongside of them, to the right of that, from my point of view, there was a plate. And there must have been a hole, a thing you could... Because you'd see something would be pushed out, and it would be a rifle. And then there'd be bang. Away would go a sandbag.
Would it actually knock it back into the trench, or just burst it?
Hmm?
Would the shot knock the sandbag back into the trench, or would it just burst the sandbag?
Well, it just smashed the thing, and half of the thing would be pushed into the trench, you see. So I thought, well, we've got to do this properly. So I borrowed I arranged for our auxiliary machine gun to be fitted up about 50 yards further down the trenches, and in the meantime, I very carefully watched and watched this again and again until I knew more or less the area. So I fixed this gun up one night, laid it on what I thought was the right area, and arranged with the gunner that the next day he would fire single shots, not more often than one shot in every 5 minutes. And I watched, and gradually I set the elevation at fairly low, and it knocked up a bit of dirt, and I said, now, gave him a signal to give the elevation a half turn to sort of raise it, and then I said, fire one shot, but not more than one every 5 minutes, don't want to give the show away. Well, slowly but surely we've got this area, you'll still see the two men, and with our gun knocking up turf or dirt or a bit of stuff right in front of this place. And I said, now hold it, keep it there overnight. And the next morning at about 9:30 to 10, the old German sniper turned up with his bang, bang, bang with the sandbags. But, and when he'd fired about three shots, I gave the signal to the chap, but I said, fire. And he put 250 rounds into this particular area. And halfway through the firing, the plate fell over, went up, and altogether it was a complete success. It knocked that chap. I don't probably killed him, I don't know, but the periscope and the firing plate and everything else was all knocked to pieces. And that's one little episode that finished that sniping.
Did that sort of thing happen often, or was that a one-off?
Well, it was. I don't know. It was something that I personally thought of. I think getting my own back on them.
Now, what would your machine gun position look like in the actual trench at that stage?
Well, it wouldn't look any much different than just a line of sandbags. You would build up sandbags, you'd mount the tripod on it, put a sandbag on each leg of the tripod, so that from a German point of view, until the gun was mounted, they probably wouldn't realise that those legs of the tripod would be visible at all. It was only when you were ready to fire that you got up there and you had to expose yourself for a moment while you fiddled and put the actual gun mount onto the tripod. Then, if there was a skillful sniper at the other side with a telescope, he might spot you, but he very, very, very rarely did. So I can't remember ever having been fired at while we were mounting.
How long would it take to mount the gun? Was it a fiddly job, or was it quite
easy? Oh, the whole thing. You do the tripod probably in the early part of the day or night, get that done, and then the actual fitting of the thing onto there was a matter of seconds, certainly more than a quarter of a minute, half a minute.
Would the machine gun post have any extra sandbags round it to sort of make it like a post?
Well, sometimes you do it, but very often you simply choose a suitable spot in the trench where you get a good field of fire, especially if it was just a little bit higher than other parts of the trench.
That was the main thing, the field of fire, was it?
Oh, yes, field of fire, yes.
Now, what was the sort of target you'd aim at, say, when you were at Heberturn
in
front of Gommercourt?
Usually it was to try and get your sights onto the German front line, and when the bullets were knocking up dirt, you know, just in front of their sandbags, you'd elevate your thing just the tiniest fraction and then press the button again and do that. And you were probably covering an area of 100 yards with this bang, 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 bang.
Backwards and forwards.
Yes.
And just skimming.
That was just the normal, ordinary firing.
And that was...
If by any chance, somebody had spotted a position where there was a gun firing from them, well, you'd watch that out area. If you spotted an actual gun being fired there, you'd lay your gun on there and wait until he appeared to be, you know, ahead of setting their sights, and then you'd let him have it.
And they'd be trying to do the same to you, presumably.
Yes, probably, yes.
Did you still... You still didn't fire your guns from your battle positions, though?
It's a fair question. I don't remember ever having them feeling that they'd sighted that particular gun. But of course, you... Don't forget that we had already moved 25 yards one way or the other away from the battle position when we were firing.
Now,
but if we spotted his gun and we were in our battle position, I can't remember, but I thought we would probably give him a short burst.